speak out against some of these raids, these arrests. So, for example, the Townhouse Gallery, the outreach director gave an interview to Ahram Online, which is a semi-official news agency here, and he sort of dismissed it, played it down. But the publisher from the publishing house, the Merit Publishing House, which was raided, he said, "This won't scare us. We will continue to dream of a free country, a country with social justice, and this won't silence us." So really different reactions to the continued ramp up against freedom of expression in Egypt.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's NPR's Leila Fadel speaking to us from Cairo on a crackdown there by the government on free speech. Let's hear now about an American presidential candidate for whom boldness comes more naturally than compromise. That would be Ted Cruz. Barely through his first year in the Senate, the Texas Republican bucked his party leaders and became the public face of a government shutdown while standing up for conservative ideals. We've been revisiting the NPR series on where candidates come from called The Journey Home. And as part of that series, Elsa Chang traveled to Houston. That's where Ted Cruz was selling a message of conservatism when he was just a teenager.
You could say Ted Cruz ran with a gang in high school. Their colors were blue jacket, white shirt, red tie. They called themselves the Constitutional Corroborators, and their leader was the head of a conservative think tank who took them around Houston to perform.
He would introduce them and say, "They're now going to write down, memorize sections of the Constitution, word for word."
Winston Elliott helped train the young recruits. The Constitutional Corroborators would roll into Rotary clubs and other civic groups, and they'd be armed with easels.
On cue, they would stand at the easel and each write out on the easel a major section. And then when they finished, he would say, "Now, each of you explain that section of the Constitution."
This is how Ted Cruz, the teenager, spent much of his spare time, hanging out two nights a week with a think tank called the Free Enterprise Institute. They discussed the Constitution, the Federalist Papers, and Anti-Federalist Papers. They'd compete in speech contests about the free market. That's where Elliot first met Cruz, when he judged the skinny high school freshman.
Suddenly, Ted just turned it on, and you just got this confidence and this clarity and explain economic principles, basic economic principles of inflation and property rights and this kind of thing. When you're in ninth grade, I mean, I think Ted was 14 then.
It was the mid-1980s, and Ronald Reagan was his hero. Cruz's father, who had emigrated from Cuba, followed the oil business down to the Houston suburbs. And there, his son inhabited a world that was safe, quiet, and insulated. If you walk around Cruz's old high school, soft music will follow you all day in the hallways. This is Second Baptist High School. It's on the campus of a megachurch tucked near a country club in a leafy, affluent neighborhood. Cruz was valedictorian here, and so was Doug Daniels the year after.
This is called the chapel.
What used to go on here?
Originally, this is where they had the dramas and the plays. I feel like he would have been in at least one play in here.
Cruz loved being on stage, even if it meant being the villain. He played the murderer Bill Sykes in Oliver and was Rolf, the young Nazi, in The Sound of Music. In his senior yearbook, Cruz is leaning dramatically into a microphone under the title Most Likely to Become the Next Geraldo Rivera. Daniels first met the future senator in Spanish class when Cruz transferred from another high school mid-year.
And it was not very long before Ted was raising his hand and answering questions, and like he had been there from not only the beginning of the class, but the beginning of the school year. At the time, I probably wouldn't have used this word, but now I will say it was intimidating.
A newcomer who refuses to hold back. That's how Cruz has marked his first couple years in the Senate, too. And it's a style that's won him legions of fans in his home state.
I think he's very passionate about things that most Texans believe, or else he wouldn't be as popular as he is.
Wally Wilkerson is the longest-serving local GOP chairman in Texas. He's been Montgomery County's chair since 1964, just north of Houston.
If you have any disagreement with Ted Cruz, it might be over his passion or his actions or whatever, but not what his beliefs are.
Cruz might not be the stereotypical Texan. He's more Ivy League than cowboy, more fighter than horse trader. But he seems to get Texas. Consider this: after infuriating many of his Senate colleagues who blamed him for the government shutdown in 2013, Cruz was the highest rated politician in all of Texas. But Wilkerson says Cruz has an unexpected weakness for a Latino from Texas.
As a Hispanic by nature and by birth, you would think the Hispanics would be attracted by that. But I think there's something there that hadn't clicked, and I think that could be a problem for him.
It's a tension that feels especially pronounced in Cruz's hometown of Houston, which is more than 40% Hispanic. Houston is no longer the city of oil rig workers. This massive, sprawling metropolis is now home to one of the most racially diverse populations in the country. Drive just 10 minutes outside Cruz's old high school and you'll see that. Along a single street, you can pop into a store and buy an Indian sari. Then walk over and pick up halal meat at a Middle Eastern market. And then catch a soccer game in Spanish at a Guatemalan bakery. The sheltered pocket where Cruz grew up bumps right up against the city of immigrants Houston has become. And many in these parts struggle to call Cruz their hometown hero, especially in a Latino neighborhood called Aldine. Near the airport, it's one of the poorest communities in Houston.
He's just so, I don't know how you say this in English, humilde. He's not a humble person to want to help people who actually need help.
Nancy Yanis says her parents came to the U.S. from El Salvador illegally 30 years ago, and she doesn't like that Cruz opposes a path to citizenship for people like her parents.
You might be from Houston, but it doesn't really seem like you care about the people in Texas, in Houston.
But Cruz's friends say he's not someone who was ever running for mayor of Houston. Cruz has stuck to the same conservative principles he used to recite as a teenager. Here's Doug Daniels again.
I don't think you'll find a single person who knew him in high school who is at all surprised where he is now. He had direction. I mean, you knew Ted had a plan.
And that plan always seemed bigger than home. The kid who was never afraid to raise his hand in class, who never avoided the stage, even if he had to play the bad guy, would naturally go for the biggest brass ring, the White House. Elsa Chang, NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
Good morning. It's 8:18, and you've tuned into Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us. Stay tuned. We'll have headlines coming up next for you from NPR and WPR. And if you want to follow news throughout the day, go to our website at WPR.org.
Support comes from Gateway, offering pathways to high in-demand IT jobs that include network security and software and web development, starting pay $50,000 to $70,000 a year. 1-800-247-7122. Choose option 2 and ask for a new student specialist.
Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support free, family-friendly events. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. In Britain today, a husband and wife plotting suicide bombings in London have been sentenced to life in prison. As Larry Miller reports, the couple stockpiled more than 22 pounds of explosives at their home.
This was one of seven viable terrorist plots Prime Minister David Cameron says was stopped in the last year. Sana Khan came from a well-off family. Her mother is a magistrate. Against family objection, she married Mohammed Rehman, described in court as a drug addict who pledged allegiance to the Islamic State. Together, they plotted to carry out suicide bombings at a shopping center or on the London subway.
They're bracing for record flooding in parts of Missouri and Illinois. That's where days of torrential rains have triggered widespread river flooding. Residents of some small towns north of St. Louis have evacuated. Sandbags are piled up in other areas. The Mississippi River is expected to rise almost 15 feet above flood stage in St. Louis by tomorrow. Meteorologist Dave Roth with the National Weather Service says it's going to take some time before those rivers return to normal.
Especially with the Mississippi, it can take days, if not weeks, for that water to flow downstream.
Missouri Governor Jay Nixon has called out the National Guard. At least 13 people in Missouri have died in the flooding in recent days. Five others have been killed in Illinois. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. Wisconsin legislators are moving toward getting rid of restrictions on nuclear power in the state. The restrictions were enacted following the meltdown at the Three Mile Island plant in Pennsylvania in 1979. State Assembly Democrats are joining Republican legislators who are pushing efforts to eliminate the restrictions. Backers of the Assembly and Senate bills say new technology could someday lower nuclear power prices and make it economical to generate energy with waste that's created. The bills would put nuclear power ahead of natural gas and coal in the state's list of energy sources. Environmental advocacy group Clean Wisconsin opposes the bill, saying it does not make sense to put nuclear power ahead of cheaper natural gas in an effort to reduce reliance on coal. Two men have died while clearing snow after a winter storm dumped a record 9 inches of snow on Milwaukee. The Milwaukee County Medical Examiner's Office says a 73-year-old man collapsed and died while snow blowing yesterday, and a 54-year-old man died while shoveling snow. More than 11 inches of snow fell in Green Bay and more than 9 inches in Fond du Lac and 7 to 10 inches in western Wisconsin. Monday's storm also stranded air travelers at the airports in Wisconsin. According to the State Department of Transportation, there were 625 car accidents by the end of the day, Monday. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the SCAN Foundation, working to advance a coordinated system of high-quality services for older adults that preserve dignity and independence. More information is available at thescanfoundation.org. From the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people from diverse backgrounds and ensure that they reach their fullest potential. More information is available at wtgrantfoundation.org. And from Emily and Antoine Van Ochtmail, supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income D.C. area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information is available at newfuturesdc.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. And if you haven't experienced virtual reality or VR yet, you may well get your chance in the coming year. New headsets are hitting the market, and they will let users experience everything from travel to games, news, and shopping. NPR's Laura Seidel looks at whether that will get consumers to spend a few hundred dollars to buy a VR headset.
Brian Blau has watched dozens of people don a virtual reality headset for the first time.
When they put it on, you can just really see the light bulbs go off. They get it right away, within the first minute or two. They turn their head around. They instantaneously realize, like, wow, I am transported.
Blau is an analyst with Gartner, and he's bullish on VR. After having my own first experience with VR nearly 2 years ago, I understand what he's saying. I tried a recreation of HBO's Game of Thrones. I got a ride, virtually, on the winch elevator up the Castle Black Wall in the Fantasy Kingdom.
I see soldiers coming up in the snow holding torches. Oh my God. And fiery arrows. Ah! I've been hit by a fiery arrow. Oh my God. Whoa.
That was me using an Oculus Rift VR headset. A few months later, Facebook paid $2 billion to buy the company. The first half of this year, Oculus is scheduled to hit the market, along with two other high-end VR headsets, Sony's Project Morpheus and HTC's Vive. Crucial to the success of these headsets will be more content, says analyst Blau.
Ultimately, it's really up to the game developers and the content developers to really provide great user experiences.
Jaunt VR recently got $65 million of investment from Disney and Madison Square Garden Company. Jaunt's already been working with Disney-owned ABC News. Among the VR experiences they've created is a visit to the historic sites of Damascus, Syria.
Up here on the wall of the citadel, Damascus lies out before you, the capital of Syria, which thousands have fled to neighboring countries and Europe.
With a VR headset, you can turn in any direction and see the city as if you were on the citadel wall.
You suddenly feel like you're actually there, and you get a sense of scale.
Jaunt CEO Jens Christensen thinks news is going to be a big category for virtual reality.
This type of news content, I think, is very powerful in VR. It really, you get a sort of a humanizing experience that you don't really get when you have a screen in front of you.
This past year, the New York Times began to experiment with VR, taking on experiences such as a journey with children displaced by war. The new world of production for virtual reality is a work in progress. Here at its Palo Alto headquarters, Jaunt has developed the equipment to shoot and edit these experiences. Jaunt's VR camera is about the size of a basketball. It's got over a dozen lenses wrapped around it. Koji Gardner, who helped develop the camera, says they've had to overcome problems like synchronizing the lens shutters together. So if you're watching somebody walk,
you see them disappear between a stitch between the two cameras. So they disappear and then reappear in the camera next to it. And that's due to those not being synchronized.
Of course, there is no guarantee that all this investment in equipment is going to pay off. Many people have compared the enthusiasm for virtual reality with the failed experiments in 3D TV. It got millions of dollars in investments, too, and required viewers to don special glasses. Analyst Blau doesn't see it that way.
I think when you look at virtual reality, it is such a different type of experience that it's hard to make those comparisons stick.
The video game experience may be one way that virtual reality takes off this year, and gamers may share that experience with their parents and grandparents, opening the VR experience to another audience and laying the groundwork for a new art form and industry. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
And as we approach the end of the year, we've been hearing from people who have been uprooted in 2015, millions around the globe by war, gangs, and famine. One of them is Rosa. That's her middle name. She doesn't want her full name used because she fears for both her own and her 13-year-old son's safety. Rosa is 33 and a single mother from El Salvador. She fled with her son from the capital city, San Salvador, last summer.
Yo salí en julio, el 22 de julio de mi país.
I left on the 22nd of July from my country. We arrived at the border on the 31st of July. We were detained by the border patrol and taken to the cooler.
The cooler. That's what Rosa calls the detention facility in which she was held by border control before being transferred to another holding facility run by ICE, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
I was taken from my son in a place in a detention center for women. We were badly treated, but I was strong because God was with me. I told God, don't leave me. But imagine seeing me with shackles on my feet, my hands, a waist chain, like I was a criminal. I always rely on God. And each morning when I got up, I told God, I am a strong woman, a brave woman, and I'm going to fight.
Rosa and her son were eventually released from detention. They are now in Virginia, staying with a relative while they seek asylum. According to Rosa, she had no choice but to leave El Salvador. She says a few members of the powerful gang MS-13 had threatened to kidnap her son if she didn't pay them $500. Rosa did not have the money, so she went to the police. One gang member was arrested, but the police warned her they could not protect her from the others.
The police, they told me the best thing is for me to disappear because in El Salvador I was dead. And so I decided to take the road to here. I've been told I have to wait. I still don't have a lawyer for my asylum case. And I'm worried because I only have a year to make it. A year, no more, to fight for my asylum. And I'm afraid to return to my country. But I did all this for my son. I don't regret it. I didn't come here for luxuries, only to save the life of my son, like other mothers who took the road here.
That's Rosa, who with her son fled El Salvador last summer. NPR did reach out to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement for a statement on separation at family detention centers. The agency declined to comment. This is NPR News.
Nearly 19,000 people died from prescription opioid overdoses last year.
The number of deaths is only a tip of the iceberg that's just indicating the pyramid of problems that lies beneath.
Doctors agree there's an epidemic of abuse, but they disagree on whether prescriptions are to blame. Prescribing for Pain, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune into All Things Considered at 3 today here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Good morning, I'm Renee Montaigne. After nearly seven decades of cutting hair, 90-year-old barber Tony Manzi is putting his clippers away. Manzi, known around Cranston, Rhode Island as Tony the Barber, is retiring tomorrow. He's seen it all in his shop, including his share of fad haircuts. He told the Providence Journal he's not impressed. And the bowl cuts that first appeared with the Beatles half a century ago, well, Manzi says, just about the ugliest thing ever. It's Morning Edition.
Good morning, it's 8:31, and you've tuned into Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hope you're having a great Wednesday morning so far. Stay with us. Still to come this hour, it's Wisconsin Life. A Wisconsin author explores her own thoughts on compassion after passing a hitchhiker on a snowy night in Wisconsin. That's Wisconsin Life coming up in 15 minutes here on WPR.
Support for WPR's marketing and promotions comes from the Harold A. Engel Memorial Communications Arts Internship Fund, helping WPR employ a graduate fellow from the Wisconsin School of Business Bolt's MBA in the Arts program.
Local musicians, get your music on the radio on WGTD's Noon Tunes. It airs Monday through Friday on the WGTD Midday News. Email Dave McGrath at mcgrathd@gtc.edu.
If travel's on your list for 2016, a full listing of WPR trips is online at wpr.org/travel. We're offering a springtime journey to South Africa and a classical music cruise on the Danube River next fall with Earthbound Expeditions. Details about the trips and registration information can be found at wpr.org/travel.
There'll be light snow developing in southern Wisconsin this morning and a chance of light snow in the south this afternoon. Light snow is likely in east central Wisconsin in the late morning and early afternoon, and there's a chance of light snow in the north. Highs will be in the mid to upper 20s today and tonight. Slight chance of light snow showers in the far north, with lows in the mid to upper teens, except in the lower 20s near Lake Michigan. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the belief that investing in women and children today ensures a healthy, prosperous future for everyone. More information is available at gatesfoundation.org. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Israel is in a standoff with Brazil. Israel chose a new ambassador to Brazil. The Brazilians are refusing to receive him, and Israel is refusing to send anybody else. This diplomatic dispute becomes a major story because of the reason for it, which we're going to explore with correspondents in both Jerusalem and in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, which is where we find NPR's Lourdes Garcia Navarro. Lourdes, what is the problem that Brazil has with the ambassador?
Well, everything, pretty much. He is someone who is involved in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in a fundamental way. Let's start with who Danny Dayan is. He was the former head of one of the main settler councils, the Yesha Council, which is a kind of umbrella organization for settlements in the occupied West Bank. Now, you know, for some countries, this might not be an issue, but Brazil has made a point of its policies on the Israeli-Palestinian issue. You know, under the former president, they recognized a Palestinian state. This president, Dilma Rousseff, withdrew her ambassador temporarily from Israel during the most recent Gaza conflict in protest over civilian deaths. So, you know, formally, what the government here is saying is that Israel's prime minister announced the appointment on Twitter. He didn't follow diplomatic protocol. But what we know is that it's about a lot more than that. It is about who Danny Dayan is.
It's a substantive disagreement with the Israeli government. But Emily Harris of NPR News, who's in Jerusalem, I want to bring you into the conversation because surely Israel's government was aware of Brazil's objections. Why did they choose this particular ambassador?
Oh, yes, they're very certainly aware of Brazil's policies. And senior Israeli officials, though, say that Prime Minister Netanyahu selected Danny Dayan as the best man for the job. They actually cite his Latin American roots. He was born not in Brazil, but in Argentina and immigrated to Israel as a teen. Dayan is not a professional diplomat, but Israeli officials say that Netanyahu knows him personally, likes him, and respects him. They also say his job would be to represent Israeli government policy, not Brazilian government policy. Certainly, supporting settlements is something that's important to the right-wing coalition government that Netanyahu has put together.
What makes it hard for either side to back down here?
Well, for Israel, a couple of things. One, Dayan is making a case that they should not back down. The backdrop for Israel is a concern that whether other countries might at some point act on often long-held policies against Israeli settlements. Most countries, even though they may not put it as forefront as Brazil, don't recognize Israel's claim to the West Bank, and they say that building homes for Jewish Israelis there, settlements, undermines a negotiated solution between the two sides. Often that policy doesn't go beyond diplomatic discussions, but already, for example, this fall, Israel saw Europe move to label at the consumer level certain products to make it clear to consumers whether they are Israeli products made in Israel as it's recognized by most international countries or whether it's made in Israeli settlements in the West Bank. Now, the EU says this was to give consumers full information. Danny Dayan, in this case, has drawn a parallel. He's saying that if Brazil refuses his appointment, it's like labeling people, not just products from Israeli settlements in the West Bank.
Well, from the Brazilian point of view, Lourdes Garcia Navarro, why would Brazilians not simply just go on with diplomacy? This is symbolic, after all.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, you know, Israel is a big provider of military technology to Brazil, and this has caused a big breach in the two sides of the government. On the one hand, you have the diplomatic side. On the other side, Brazil's military has been quoted in the local press as being quite upset that this diplomatic standoff could affect the military relationship. But we spoke yesterday with a man who is Dilma Rousseff's defense minister. His name is Celso Amorim, and he's come out pretty strongly saying Brazil should not allow itself to be pressured by Israel. He says Israel is trying to legitimize the settlements. And he said, quote, Dayan is the leader of a policy condemned by the United Nations. And as such, it would go against Brazil's interests and world peace to allow him to become ambassador here. And for the moment, it doesn't look like the Brazilians are going to be standing down on this issue.
Okay, that's NPR's Lourdes Garcia Navarro in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. And NPR's Emily Harris in Jerusalem. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
They're discussing Brazil's refusal to receive an ambassador from Israel.
And the Iowa caucuses, they're now just weeks away. Candidates for the Republican nomination are gearing up for their first real test, and that has particular significance for Donald Trump, who so far has been able to measure his political strength by polls alone and not votes. NPR's Sarah McCammon attended a rally for Trump in Iowa last night.
Donald Trump stood before a packed arena last night in Council Bluffs near the Missouri River. He told the crowd that he came prepared.
I even brought my Bible, the evangelicals, okay? We love the evangelicals.
That group is key to winning Iowa's Republican caucuses. Trump said he loves the Bible even more than one of his own books.
It's the best. We love the art of the deal, but the Bible is far, far, far superior, right? Yes.
Trump told Iowans that if he becomes president, he'll make sure their coveted first in the nation status is preserved. He also promised to campaign in the state so much in the coming weeks that Iowans will say,
we can't stand him anymore, but I'm going to be here anyway because we have to win.
He did not focus on polls that show him slipping as rival Ted Cruz surges in Iowa. Trump took this jab at the Texas senator whose father was born in Cuba.
You got to remember, in all fairness, to the best of my knowledge, not too many evangelicals come out of Cuba. Okay, just remember that.
19-year-old Ryan McDermott of Council Bluffs says he's deciding between Trump and Cruz. He likes Trump's bold tone.
Like, he says how it is. He doesn't sugarcoat it. That's kind of what America needs.
But McDermott says any Republican would be better than a Democrat. Trump not only needs to win over undecided voters, but also make sure his supporters turn out on caucus night, as he reminded voters in Council Bluffs.
So February 1st, get out and vote. Get out and vote. Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
A message Iowans will be hearing from lots of presidential hopefuls in the coming weeks. Sarah McCammon, NPR News, Council Bluffs, Iowa.
And later today on All Things Considered, an investigation from member station KPCC looks at police shootings here in Los Angeles and how officers are being trained when it comes to using deadly force. This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 8:41. Thanks for tuning in to Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us. Headlines are coming up next from NPR and WPR. And then in 10 minutes on Marketplace Morning Report, a look ahead on all things employment in the year 2016. That plus all the morning's business news in 10 minutes here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, more of our favorite interviews from 2015. Gloria Steinem reflects on the choices she made in her life, a life that has profoundly influenced women around the world. And Jeffrey Tambor talks about his Emmy-winning performance as a transgender woman in the Amazon series Transparent. Season 2 is now on Amazon. Join us.
Tune in to Fresh Air tonight at 7 here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Iraq's military commanders say U.S.-led airstrikes were key in helping Iraqi troops recapture the city of Ramadi from ISIS. Hundreds of airstrikes allowed Iraqi forces to make advances on the city about 60 miles outside Baghdad. NPR's Tom Bowman says a much bigger operation for Iraqi troops will be retaking the city of Mosul.
They estimate that they could retake Mosul by the end of next year or early 2017, but American officials think that's wildly optimistic. It'll take a lot longer for them to take Mosul. It's a huge city, roughly 2 million people, and estimates of anywhere from 800 to 2,000 ISIS fighters.
No damage or injuries are reported after last night's 4.4 earthquake in Southern California. It was centered east of Los Angeles in the foothills near San Bernardino. Another earthquake with a magnitude of 4.8 was felt in northern Washington state late last night. Craig McCulloch says that one was centered in Canada, not far from Victoria.
There has been considerably bigger earthquakes in the Vancouver and Seattle area in the past. There are several subduction zones where geological plates smash and slide against each other. People here are always waiting for the so-called big one, so this will be a wake-up call.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down 47 points, the NASDAQ off 12. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Maureen McCullum. Wisconsin's job creation agency will likely not get a major overhaul. Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss says he's changed his mind about a rebranding effort for the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, which he first proposed a few weeks ago. Voss says state and local business leaders believe the Wedix brand is fine as it is, and many changes have been made in making its job creation grants and loans to businesses more accountable to taxpayers. Voss says it's possible that lawmakers could restore at least some of the $46 million in cuts it made from Wedix's current two-year budget. The speaker says he favors additional funds so county and regional economic groups can give out more loans as job creators on a local basis. Officials in Waukesha County say power failures caused 1 million gallons of sewage and wastewater to flow into the Fox River just before Christmas. It happened after a tree fell onto the wastewater plant's main utility line and transformer during a rainstorm with wind gusts up to 56 miles per hour. The city is also trying to find out whether circuit breakers were inadvertently shut off when construction work was done recently. The outages occurred the night of December 23rd and continued into Christmas Eve. A report to the state DNR, city officials say the plant's building was flooded by wastewater and the sewage mixture went into an emergency pipe that goes towards the Fox River. This is WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Kresge Foundation, expanding opportunities in America's cities through grant making and social investing. More at kresge.org. From American Jewish World Service, working for 30 years to end poverty and advance human rights worldwide. Learn more at ajws.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, supporting innovative solutions to the world's most pressing problems with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship. More information is available at skoll.org.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. Driving home on a snowy night, Crystal Chan and her mother encountered a hitchhiker in the blowing snow. The question of whether to pick him up or not led her to explore the meaning and limits of compassion.
It was a bad snowstorm, the kind that wipes out your vision, erases the world, and makes you brake for a red light a full city block before you come to the intersection. It was nighttime, and my mom and I were in the car heading home over the viaduct on 20th Avenue in Oshkosh. The radio was off as my mom handled the vehicle on the heavy, slippery roads. That was when we saw him, a figure, hunched over, walking on the sidewalk on that viaduct in full blast of the winter storm. In fact, because of the storm, we almost didn't see him. What could he possibly be doing in a storm like this? I asked my mom. I don't know, she said. He trudged along. We inched along. Mom paused. Should we pick him up? I was surprised at her question. There are dangers out there, murderers and rapists and thieves. There we were, two women in a car in a snowstorm, the heater blazing. There he was, a young man, hunched over into the blinding winds, almost disappeared from view. You couldn't help but feel for him. I'd never picked up anyone before. I had a good hunch that my mom hadn't either. Yeah, I said. Let's pick him up. I rolled down my window. Hey, where are you going? I asked. He told us. The location was halfway across town. In the darkness, I looked at Mom and she looked at me. I looked back at him. Come on in if you want, I said. We'll take you there. We rolled to a slow stop, and he opened the door to the back seat. A blast of cold air followed him in. We asked him some general questions, but he didn't say much, so we crawled through town in silence. I was sweating under my winter coat. He is in our car, I thought. I cannot believe we actually picked up a stranger. Mom gripped the steering wheel with both hands. The man spoke only to give us directions to the house, and when we pulled alongside it, he thanked us twice, then got out. As soon as he left, it was as if a sudden storm had lifted, even though it was still snowing. We turned around and crawled our slow way home, both deeply shaken, both deeply pleased. It's easy to say that compassion is a good thing. It's much harder to live it out, especially when you need to weigh things like risk and danger and fear. Mom and I both agreed that had we been the only one in the car, we would have kept driving. If there had been two men walking, we would have kept driving, and so forth. There are no easy answers, and I've messed up this equation more times than I'd like, preferring the route of safety to the route of lived-out compassion. But in extending that gesture of decency, somehow I felt more human in the process, more connected, less alone. It can be mysterious how compassion works and how the strangest gifts can come in the strangest packaging in a snowstorm on a cold winter night.
Crystal Chan is a storyteller and the author of the book, Bird. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit our website at wisconsinlife.org and find us on Facebook. It's 10 minutes before 9 o'clock, and you're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Classical music starts at 9, and today's music includes a beautiful harp concerto by Handel, plus music by Mozart. You can enjoy classical music from 9 to 3 each weekday here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market. The market opens Saturdays during the cold weather season in the atrium of the Rohde Center for the Arts in downtown Kenosha is currently on break. It'll reopen Saturday, January 9th. For more, visit KenoshaHarborMarket.com.
Radical robots and gadgets galore. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support science exploration and education. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.
There will be light snow developing in southern Wisconsin this morning. There's a chance of light snow in the south in the afternoon. Light snow is likely in east central Wisconsin in the late morning and early afternoon. And there's a chance of light snow in northern Wisconsin.
Support for WPR comes from American Transmission Company. ATC provides a pathway for power into communities throughout Wisconsin. ATC owns and operates the high-voltage electric transmission system that helps keep the lights on, businesses running, and communities strong.
Support for WGTD comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Andrea's, a proud supporter of programming on WGTD HD.
In a few minutes, what to study to get a job.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From Marketplace in New York, I'm David Brancaccio. First, a warning today about 2016 from the influential head of the IMF, one of the biggest of global lenders. For that, let's check in with economist David Kelly, chief global strategist at JP Morgan Funds. Morning to you.
Good morning.
There's a piece in the German daily Handelsblatt today. The head of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, is talking about the global economy for 2016. She thinks it's going to continue to be a disappointment. Does that jibe with your view?
Well, I think the global economy is going to grow slowly. There are problems in emerging markets. China is slowing at a gradual pace. There's obviously a huge recession, really depression in Brazil. There are problems in some other commodity producers. And then the developed countries, you know, they're doing okay. They're really doing okay by the standards of their own capabilities, but they're not the same economies they were a few decades ago. And so overall, I agree that growth will be slow next year.
It's interesting. She has a specific worry here. Companies with a lot of dollar-denominated debt are at risk when U.S. interest rates go up, she observes. Mass defaults could then infect banking systems and governments, she was warning. I guess that's something to hopefully not look forward to in 2016.
I also don't think it's something the IMF should be so passive about. I mean, why is she saying this? She's saying this because she's afraid of extreme exchange rate movements. But if there's any organization in the world that ought to try to sort of get central banks around the table to try and prevent extreme exchange rate movements, it is in fact the IMF. It is certainly the world is threatened by big swings in currencies, but I actually think the IMF itself is in the catbird seat in organizing global central banks in trying to prevent this happening, which is in nobody's interest.
And she's certainly not a bull, is she? She's not here talking up the global economy, I suppose.
I think I'm going to include the head of the IMF as a central banker in this regard. I think a central banker is a little bit like a coach of a football team. I mean, they've got to come up with the right strategy, but they also should tell the team that they're going to win. And I think that the constant downbeat messages coming from the IMF, as from other central banks, saps global confidence. Global confidence is really what it's all about. And I don't like the message of being so negative in tone. And I also think the IMF should be a little bit more active in trying to do something about volatile currencies around the world.
David Kelly at JP Morgan Funds. Thank you.
Sure.
That faint ringing in our ears about 24 minutes ago might have been the opening bell on Wall Street. The Dow is down 46 points, about 0.25%. The S&P 500 down by a similar percentage. The NASDAQ composite down 0.4%. We're also carefully watching interest rates today. The 10-year bond yield has spiked upward, up at 2.32%. Crude oil, using the New York benchmark, is down 2.4%, under $37 a barrel. There's a view that there's just too much oil about, given warnings about the health of key global economies of the sort we just discussed, coming from the head of the IMF. A lot of people like to buy the Standard & Poor's 500 index of stocks. It's run by robots, so fees tend to be low. Set it and forget it. Well, this year, that strategy was not lucrative. As of this morning, the S&P 500 is up for the year, but not by even 1%. However, within those 500 stocks, which company did the best this last year? Turns out it's Netflix, up 142%. Number two is Amazon. What had an especially lousy 2015? Look up nearly any company that's in the oil or mining business.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by RingCentral, the cloud communications system that integrates with CRM, sales, and support applications like Salesforce, Zendesk, Box, and now Google for Work. More at ringcentral.com.
I'll never forget my guidance counselor telling me the results of my aptitude test, suggesting I should study to become a petroleum engineer. I would have been out of work in the early 1980s when I graduated college when crude prices collapsed, and I would have been out of work now given all these energy prices. But what do the data tell us about the best jobs as we get into this new year? We've been talking about the year to come with our reporters on the beat. Our Mitchell Hartman covers employment and labor markets, and let's connect to him in Portland, Oregon. Good morning, Mitchell.
Hi, David.
All right, so what is this great field for all of us? Nanotechnology?
Oh, no, David, that's a small field. It's healthcare, and it's the one we've been hearing about for years, but really the trend seems to have arrived. Baby boomers are retiring, and they need healthcare. There's more people insured under Obamacare. They need care as well. So the Bureau of Labor Statistics puts out something called the Employment Projections Report. It goes out 10 years. They just updated their predictions to the year 2024. Healthcare and social service jobs, they grow the fastest over that time, become more than 13% of the entire workforce. This sector overtakes professional and business services and all government jobs by 2024. It's going to be fully one in four of all the new jobs added in the next decade.
But which jobs exactly? I mean, it may not be the best time to become a doctor, per se.
Well, so for this, I went to Susan Martindale. She's a senior manager with the job recruiting and search site Simply Hired. So they crunched all the jobs offered this year nationwide on their platform, and they ranked them.
The jobs that showed the most growth, the top six of them are all in healthcare. And in fact, about half of the top 20 jobs that showed a lot of growth were in the healthcare industry.
These jobs, it's topped by pharmacy technician, operating room technician, registered and licensed practical nurse, then physical therapist, physician's assistant. All those occupations grew in double digits this year.
Now, you're not going to just fall into these new healthcare jobs. I mean, they sound like they require specialized training.
Looking at both the results from Simply Hired and also the government, these coming jobs in healthcare pretty much do run the gamut. You know, in hospitals and nursing homes, you are going to need a lot of basic caregivers. You need cleaning people for older patients as well.
So we have some very highly educated, highly skilled jobs like surgeons have shown some growth this year. But you also see jobs like medical assistants or personal care aides that you can get with a high school diploma and maybe a little bit of a certification.
However, I will say, you know, this lower end of the skill scale in healthcare, it's also much lower wage scale. Jobs for people with just a high school diploma that used to pay pretty well, many of those jobs, you know, don't pay so well, just around $20,000 to $30,000 a year.
Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman, thank you for this.
You're welcome, David.
And there's news that a Swiss bank has reached the outlines of a settlement with U.S. authorities after allegations it helped wealthy U.S. clients evade taxes. Bank Julius Baer has now set aside $547 million for possible penalties. The bank says it expects to stay profitable this year and next. Julius Baer, when you go to its website, describes itself as the international reference point in private banking based on a solid Swiss heritage, unquote. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
And there's more business news coming up this evening on Marketplace. starting at 6:30. That's right after All Things Considered here on WPR. And of course, the Morning Report comes your way every hour during Morning Edition, each weekday. Stay with us.
Support for WPR comes from Five9s, a Wisconsin-based cloud service provider offering IT consulting, management, and hosting for user devices, applications, servers, and networks. Online at the5nines.com.
Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market. The market opens Saturdays during the cold weather season, and the atrium of the Rohde Center for the Arts in downtown Kenosha is currently on break. It'll reopen Saturday, January 9th. For more, visit KenoshaHarborMarket.com. You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake